You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today, I'm very pleased to have on, Ruth Harkin. You may recognize that name because she is the wife of former Iowa Senator Tom Harkin. She's written a very good new book called When My Husband Ran for President and Other Short Stories. And that's our topic today. And I'm very delighted to have her as a guest. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on Heartland Politics.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to join you.
It's a really interesting book. My first question out of the box is, why did you decide to write this and especially talk about the format of it? It's a series of very short stories that I think is very interesting.
Right. Well, I've been writing over the years, and I first started getting serious about writing short little stories, little vignettes, when I was taking an editing course after law school. And then I started talking with my coach, and we decided to write some stories for fun. And then at some point, I'm in a writing circle down in the Bahamas. And at some point, we started talking about putting all of our writings together and publishing them. Well, at that point, my writings were scattered all over. Some had been written only in longhand. Some were in an email form. Some had been destroyed by Dorian in the hurricane that hit the Bahamas. So I gathered all these together, and I really wanted to write a little book for my children. And then I was talking to friends, and they said, you know, we think that you've got a sort of a wider audience than just your children, just because of you've always been in public life, your husband's been in public life. And so we think you ought to broaden out a little bit. And my publisher was all for that. And so he, particularly Steve Sipkin, has really broadened out my scope for my book. And I've sold a lot of copies. So that's good.
It's a great, you still got time to rush out and buy this for Christmas, folks. It would be a great little stuffing stocker. But what struck me was, of course, everybody's familiar with your husband, Tom Harkin, who served 24 years in the U.S. Senate.
No. He served 30 in the Senate and 10 in the House. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I got my numbers mixed up. But I thought you have a very incredible story to tell in your own right. And I have to admit, I wasn't aware of some of this. But first, before we get to the campaign, which is the name of the book, I want to talk about yourself a little bit. You were really kind of a pioneer in the women's movement, especially in women trying to juggle careers with also families. That was challenging probably at the beginning, wasn't it?
It was, because not that many people who were well-educated, women who were well-educated, really thought that's what they should be doing. But I really come from a long line of women who worked outside the home in professions. My grandmother and my mother was a teacher. And so it was natural for me to think about having my own career and balancing children and career. Of course, it was interesting when Tom started running for office, and I had run for office and won before he got elected. So that was sort of good for me. And I remember talking to a judge friend of mine who was a mentor, and I said, you know, now that Tom is running for Congress and has won, it looks like he's going to stay in politics. how would you advise me on my career? And he said, you know, nobody gives a damn about wives, so you should do what you want to do. And to me, that was very liberating. I thought, yeah, why don't I just do what I want to do? And so that's what I've done.
You mentioned there that you actually were an elected official, which I wasn't aware of. Talk about that, and the that's a totally different era when women didn't hold office as nearly as much as they do now. How much resistance did you face to that, and how did you overcome that?
Well, I never wanted to run for public office, but the Democratic County Chair of Story County paid me a visit when my husband and I were studying for the bar. He was running for Congress, and I was going to work on his campaign. And I had a job as a legal aid lawyer in Des Moines that I was going to take when that campaign was over. So Phyllis, the county chair, came over and said to me, you know, I'm trying to have a full Democratic slate of candidates, and I don't have anybody for county attorney. And you and your husband are the only two Democratic county attorneys. He's running for Congress, so I'd really like you to run for county attorney. And I said, wait a minute, I'm going to be a legal aid lawyer. I don't want to run for office. This isn't something I want to do. And she said, don't worry. You are never going to win. This is just a placeholder. You're never going to win. So don't worry about it. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, sure, sign me up. I didn't even bother asking Tom about it because she was so certain I was not going to win, and I was going to do something else. Well, I won. And not only did I win, I was the only Democrat in the whole county that won anything. So now I was head of a party as well as being the only Democratic office holder. And none of this was my intent.
But you know what?
I found out that I had the characteristics and the personality and background that usually went with successful prosecutors. And so German Lutheran, you know, not afraid to make choices and judgments. And so it worked out well. And I ran for re-election unopposed.
That's incredible. And that's Story County, which back then was totally different politically than it is now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you brought up, I should take a step back, in small town Minnesota, and here you
Correct.
Come to Iowa and elected county attorney, and you wind up taking top jobs and with the Department of Ag and with the Vice President Gore, I believe, at the time. I mean, that's quite a rise. How is it, like, when you go to Washington and you get these top jobs to – I imagine it's hard to kind of stay true to your values that you were brought up with in small towns and in Iowa.
Well, I didn't really feel that way. My husband and I have never felt that way. Part of it because we really didn't join the society of Washington. What we had time for was our jobs and our children. That was sort of it. And of course our neighbors and friends, but then everything we did in Iowa. So we never really got involved in that. And I know what you're talking about. Some people come to Washington and they never heard of where they came from. But that wasn't true for us.
And your career was culminated by your induction into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame. That had to have been pretty satisfying to recognize all the work you had done throughout your career.
Yeah, that was, and I appreciated it, and I'm grateful to them for that recognition.
Before we move to the more political angle and Tom's career, one of the chapters I thought that was interesting was called "Hooked on Girls Basketball," and this is from 1986. Because I'm old enough to remember when in Illinois, where I was brought up in a smaller town, when girls basketball first started. But what led you to be so engaged with girls basketball?
Well, I think because my daughter was involved in it, and I understood there was a whole, when I started coming to practice, the practices, as did Tom, we were all the parents were just so involved in the whole thing and all eager to be involved. And we just loved it. Yeah.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson. I'm very delighted to have today as my guest, Ruth Harkin. She's written a book called When My Husband Ran for President and Other Short Stories. It's a good book on many, many levels. It's revealing Senator Harkin's rise to become a U.S. senator, some stories about that, but also about Ruth Harkin, Tom's wife, and her own story, and a lot of interesting side notes and just takes on this world we live in. And I think it's beyond just a political book. I think people would enjoy it just for some of the life lessons that are learned along the way. I have to ask you to take a minute and read a little bit of your book. And this goes back to more, we'll talk a little bit about the politics, but when you first met Tom, and there's a chapter devoted to that, if you could read it. To my listeners, it's a short chapter. Her book is short chapters, so it won't take long, but I think you'll find this interesting.
Right. Well, as a young college grad running a service club for enlisted men just south of the DMZ, that separates North and South Korea. Believe me, I was at an outpost. In the mid-60s, with no phones, no cars, and dusty roads, oxen and bikes were the main sources of transportation. I lived in a Quonset hut with five other American women, and we walked up the hill for meals at the officers' club. In the spring of 67, I took an R&R, which was a rest and relaxation trip to Tokyo, which was the largest city at that time. Tokyo, with its many cars, was glitzy, clean, modern, and I checked into the Tokyo Hilton, the lap of luxury. This was quite a change from the long gray winter months in my Quonset hut in Korea, and I made the most of it. One afternoon, I wandered through the grounds of a beautiful Shinto shrine. They were having a little festival with snow cones and cotton candy. The cotton candy was irresistible, and I happily continued my stroll around the grounds, eating it. "Say, could I have a bite of that cotton candy?" I heard a voice ask. I turned around to see a great good-looking guy smiling at me. "Sure," I said, surprised to hear a Midwestern accent. "Where are you from?" We discovered that we were fellow Midwesterners from towns of less than 400 people. He from Iowa and I from Minnesota. Our conversation at dinner was fun. We bantered about Iowa and Minnesota, the war, politics, you name it. And toward the end of the meal, things took an unexpected turn. "You know, I live in a place called Dreamland," he smiled. I laughed. "Are you kidding me? You want to bet?" We drove out of Tokyo down winding country roads to almost total darkness, except for the headlights of his car. What was I thinking? I do make impulsive decisions, but this wasn't reasonable. Dinner, yes, but not heading out into the countryside late at night in search of this dreamland with a total stranger. What could possibly come of this? Finally, he pulled up to a 12-story pagoda. He guided me through the lobby, and we took an elevator to the 12th floor. We walked through the suite to the balcony. "Here we are. Look down," he said. It was an amusement park. And there it was in large neon lights, Dreamland.
Meeting over cotton candy.
That's right. Now that's quite a pickup line, you know?
Yes, it is. That's funny. So, of course, Tom served in the House and then ran for the Senate. And then speculation came up where he could run as for the presidency. What were your initial feelings about that? That's a total life changer, running for president.
Oh, it really is. And I must say that I wasn't enamored of the idea at all. And neither were our two daughters, who were going here to public school in Alexandria, Virginia. And we had a nice lifestyle and we thought everything was great. And Tom said, "No, I really want to run because it's the right time to run. You know, Democrats have a good shot at the campaign this year." So he ran.
And so that you know, it's somewhat different from now, but a lot of it's still the same, and the dependence on money in order to run a campaign. I mean, I bet that was like overwhelming, the number of details, because I'm, you know, as the book points out, you've got a front row seat to this and you're heavily involved in your husband's campaign.
Right. And you're right. The reason why people drop out of presidential campaigns usually is because they run out of money. And they realize that as they go into various states, they do not have the resources needed to compete in a way they would like to compete. And so there came a point in time that our advisory committee got together with Tom, and we decided that he would have to get out of the race.
He represents, well, I have to say, since he retired, Iowa Democrats have fallen on hard times, and we can maybe talk about that a little bit as well. But if you go back for our listeners, Tom came from a, you know, represented a rural district in Congress, and Iowa, of course, is a rural state, and it's totally different, you know, now as far as how did he get, how do you think, what was the key to his popularity back then in getting reelected, you know, with a large share of the state was conservative. In fact, Chuck Grassley and he served
together,
you know,
yeah,
together for many, many years. What accounted for his popularity?
Well, Tom, first of all, really likes people, and he's very approachable. But the thing is, in all of his campaigns, we knocked on doors, we met people in their community, and during all the time that Tom was in public office, he was back in Iowa once a week, meeting people. And if you look at where he all went, he was constantly going to events and constantly being there. So there was nothing absentee about Tom. And when he got elected to, well, first of all, when he ran for the House, he beat every single one of his opponents and they never ran again. And then when he was in the Senate, he was the first Democratic Senate ever to be reelected in Iowa. So that's really something, you know?
Yes, it is. He seemed to me, when I look back at those days, the quality he had that so many politicians don't have now from both parties is authenticity. He just seemed very authentic, that he didn't go around and poll to tell him how to feel about something. He just felt it and he explained it, and people reacted to that.
Yeah, and he draws people out, so he has a way of asking them how they're feeling about something, and it's a two-way conversation. There was never a one-way conversation with Tom. He was always involved in conversations.
So I imagine it was bittersweet when he had to drop out of the race. I mean, do you feel that he made enough of an impact on the race by his positions and being there on the stage for the time he was there?
Yes. I think he made a difference, and he sort of changed the way Clinton might have run to be more receptive to certain things. And of course, then Tom continued on his Senate career and stayed in the Senate. So yes. But I do think it was his race was impactful, not as much as he had run for president, of course, or won, but I think he made a difference in the race. Yes.
I have to talk too about, and this was, I laughed out loud when I read this. You started, you talked about the Harkin steak fry and how it's kind of a misnomer, but talk about the beginnings of how that started for our listeners. I bet a lot of people have been to that. Listeners that are Democrats have been to that. It became an annual event that attracted a lot of people, a lot of presidential candidates, nationally known folks.
Right.
But how did that start?
Well, it really started because a friend of ours, Gary Kiernan, said, you know, let's have a fundraiser and let's raise a few dollars at my place, and we'll come. Why don't you come up to my place, and we'll have some steaks and beer and we'll have a good time and charge people for it. And it just took off. So every year it got more and more people. It was amazing. And so it did become an annual event. Tom would always try to get guests to come to it to headline it. And one of the most interesting things, and the state prize started in 1974 and went through 2014. Okay. And one of the most amazing things about the steak fry is that people usually always said yes to Tom's invite to come and speak. And the one person that didn't was Barack Obama. And Tom asked him, and Barack said, he was in the Senate then, just newly elected to the Senate. And he said, no, I really can't come because there's speculation I might run for president, and I don't want to go out there and give an impression I might be thinking of it. And Tom said, well, that would be the perfect opportunity for you to do that. Well, Barack said no. And then Tom called Senator Durbin, his colleague, and said, you've got to get Barack to come out here. What could be better than testing the waters into, you know, lily white Iowa, right? And Durbin said, absolutely. He agreed to talk to Barack. So a couple days later, Barack comes back to Tom. And he said, do you have anybody yet for your steak fry? And Tom said, no. And he said, well, I'd like to do it. I think it might be good for me testing the waters. So he came out and he was just mobbed. It was a mob scene for him out there. And that was really the beginning of his campaign for president.
Yeah, I remember those days like a rock star almost.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah.
So technically, it's not really, you don't fry the steaks.
No, grilled, we never did. I don't know why we called it that. We never did fry the steaks. You know, they were always over a charcoal broiler and yeah, we never did fry them.
You know, I another little interesting point here before we wrap up, but I thought it was interesting. You talk about how you're pack rats and the values of thrift. And I think back to that, my parents, it's the generations coming through, you know, the Depression and those types of values where you just kind of approach things differently. Is that kind of where you think that came from? And might talk about that a little bit.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And both of my grandmothers, and particularly my maternal grandmother, saved everything. There wasn't things that I at that stage would have thrown away. I mean, she just saved everything. And it was because of the Depression. And now that is a little habit that can go too far. You could start saving stuff that you will never, ever in a million years use. And of course, our children today would never keep half the stuff that we kept. But when we started going to this island in the Bahamas, that's how you live on an island. So that those values came in very handy there. There is nothing I know of that's ever thrown away on that island. So we were sort of up to the challenge of living there because knowing, no, you can't let go of that little piece of string. You just never know when you may need it.
Well, I thought it was interesting too that you used the phrase modernity invades. It was like you really didn't want too much of modern conveniences there.
No, that's true because it was such a serene and beautiful place. It still is. But the beauty of it was no one was down there. Yeah. And so you could be on your property all day and never see anybody.
So you kind of want to keep it that way and not despoil it with more forms of modern life. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Well, we got time here, Ruth. I want to allot the last question. I got a couple minutes here. If you could take like 2 minutes, talk about the Harkin Center. I know a lot of people are aware of it. Maybe some aren't. But when did it start? What's the mission? And what would you like people to know about it?
Well, we started the Harkin Institute, and first of all, we started over in Ames, and then moved it to Drake, and we operated out of a storefront, and it was becoming too small for all the work we were doing and the students who were interning there and whatever. And we were working on the issues, some of the big issues that Tom had worked on when he was in the Senate. And the Americans with Disabilities is his chief piece of legislation. And so finally we decided to move to another place, and we decided there wasn't one available at Drake, and we built a building with the help of an architect who himself is in a wheelchair. And so this is the most totally accessible building in the United States to people with disabilities. And we're going to begin a certification project here where buildings can be certified to be just right for people with disabilities. So we raise money constantly for our staff and for the building in the form of an endowment to endow the whole institute. But the building is really state of the art, and when people see it, they're just amazed. There's not another building like it.
Well, as somebody who had aunts and grew up with folks with disabilities, I was always appreciative of the senator's efforts in that regard and your continuing work. Is the Harkin Center solely focused on the folks with disabilities, or is there a broader mission?
No, there's a broader mission because we also work on retirement security issues. And we also work on prevention and health care, agriculture. So we have other issues we work on, but it's all housed in this building that is just right for the disabled.
Very good. Well, Ruth, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be my guest today on Heartland Politics. Ruth Harkin has been our guest. She's the author of When My Husband Ran for President and other short stories, a very engaging and good book, and very timely book. So I thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you very much. It was great being with you and to all your listeners out there.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.